Fright Rags is your number one source for horror t-shirts. With specially curated collections created by renowned horror artists, they offer the best art and the best quality anywhere. They are back just in time for Halloween. All the General Mills monsters are back with shirts, pins, and more. Get your Frankenberry, Booberry, Fruit Brute, Yummy Mummy, and Count Chocula merch while you can. Try to say all that five times fast. Also currently, Fright Rags is celebrating a month of Myers with all new assorted Halloween t-shirts, pins, and more. Look for the Ad Nauseam book and t-shirt combo, the Trick or Treat collection, and the amazing Stephen King birthday collection. They've got you fully clothed for the Halloween season. So head on over to fright-rags.com now, and you can enter the code SUMMERSHOCK10. Well, it's fall time now, but you can use SUMMERSHOCK10 at checkout to get 10% off your entire order. Again, it's SUMMERSHOCK10, so head on to fright-rags.com now for all the good stuff.
Fangoria is back. Resurrected just in time for this Halloween, the magazine that set the standard is back as a deluxe 100-page quarterly edition. Featuring the much-anticipated Halloween sequel, the new issue features set visits, deep dives, new discoveries, fiction, and exclusive artwork. Check it out now. But it's not just a magazine anymore. Fangoria is also bringing you novels under its Fangoria Presents label, and Fango is also getting into the movie biz. Be sure to check out their recent release, Puppet Master the Little Reich. Head on over to Fangoria.com and subscribe to Fangoria now. Subscription is $60 and will save you about $20 off the cover price. Worth every penny. I got one right here in front of me.
I love
it. Fangoria.com. Subscribe now. Okay, and welcome to episode number 117 of Shockwaves. Wow, we're down. It's crazy. I'm here. Rob G's here.
Ryan Turek is here. Yeah.
We're down a cane.
Everybody else has got Captain Trips. They're just dying off.
We're down a cane who I think is still on his way back from New York.
Is he?
I think he's, you know.
I don't even know what he's doing.
We can't keep track of the cane and his madness. Beck is still shooting her movie.
Beck is on set.
Which apparently is going well.
Yeah, very excited.
But we have a co-host. Secretly in the room.
I might have just been pimping his shit.
Oh, this is one we wanted to – somebody we wanted to have on the show. Somebody that I've been friends with for so long. In fact, I am still looking for evidence that we were not actually separated at birth because I'm pretty sure we were.
I'm pretty sure we were.
You've never been on a show?
Never been on this podcast, no. He's an East Coast guy. Nope.
No.
We're talking to Ben from Fright Rags. Welcome.
Thanks for having me. This is awesome, and it's very surreal because I listen to the show every week.
Now we're listening to you every
week.
Yeah, your show.
Yeah.
What inspired – well, we're going to get into Fright Rags stuff, but what inspired the podcast? Because
I don't know. I think it was
Saturday Night Rewind, the show.
Right, yeah. Saturday Night Rewind's the podcast. We were all just sitting around. I mean, we just sit around at lunch or whatever talking and just, you know, there'd be times during the office hours where we're just hanging out and talking. It's like, this should kind of be a podcast. It'd be kind of fun just to, I don't know, just put on some mics and keep talking the way we do. And maybe people would dig hearing some other stuff. And it's not just about the shirts, but about the stuff that we grew up watching and anything else. And honestly, being inspired by you guys and other podcasts I listen to, and it's like, well, hell, why don't we just get on the microphone and start talking about stuff and how we all interact as a group and just go from there?
Well, what I like about it is that you guys are a brand. You're a company. And going kind of – excuse me, I'm drinking tea – going behind the scenes of what the company's all about and the personalities that help focusing on the personalities that help bring this quality product, I think it's just another great way of – just not customer service, but just getting to know you.
It's another layer.
And you don't see a lot of companies do that. That's what I really liked about it, because it's like you've got all these kids and all these horror fans that love your t-shirts and love your brand and love your company. And then they're like, oh, I want to know who Ben is. I want to know who Tansky is. And it's cool. It's like, you know, it's getting to know you guys. It's that very uncorporate way of having a website. And when you click the About Us, and it's these very stuffy photos right. of like, here's chief executive, here's the customer service, here's HR. And you're like, nah, I just want to hear you guys talk about what your video store picks are, you know, and what horror movies inspired you as kids. So it's really, really well done. I've been listening. I'm
well, thanks.
Yeah, and the thing, you know, the thing about Fright Rags in general as a company is you could tell from the properties you go after, the kind of I don't want to call them gimmicks, but maybe the collections. Like sometimes you do the masks and, you know, socks and things like that. You could tell from the quality of the product and the ideas that are going behind it that obviously you and your crew have a deep affinity for the horror genre. And it's weird because how long ago did you start this company now at this point?
15 years.
15 years. Yeah. So I'm originally from the East Coast. I remember meeting you probably around then.
First Monster Mania 2005 that I did.
Yes, in Cherry Hill, New Jersey.
Yeah,
that was your first convention.
You and Mike Cucinata.
Yeah, from Icons of Fright. Yeah, yeah.
I think I still have your business card.
Oh, God.
You had a MySpace
that
page on it or something.
MySpace was huge back then, let me tell you. But what was cool was, I guess, you know, it was like the early days of the web where nobody really knew what they were doing, but there was some fun stuff to it. The horror t-shirt business is huge now, especially with, you know, Hot Topic over the years and like it being kind of cool and quirky, like Nightmare Before Christmas and these kind of things, which is fine. But I remember your early shirts were things like the silhouette of the three kids from Halloween 3 or, you know, just the Atkins phase or whatever.
What Would Jason Do?
What Would Jason Do is the – that was the beginning. Yeah. Right. Did you have any inkling that t-shirts would end up being your career?
Hell no. No. I mean, it was always the dream, you know, like it was always the dream of being like, man, one day I could do this for a living and sit around watching horror movies all day, which is totally not the case when you're doing this for a living because you get less time to do stuff that you really want to do because you're so focused on work.
Yeah.
But it was never, I never thought, oh no, I could actually do this as a job. I mean, when I had my first meeting with my accountant, he was like, well, when you start becoming profitable, I'm like, what do you mean? Profitable, like you can actually start making money on this. Like, I'm just doing this as a hobby, like buying some shirts, selling them just so I can make more shirts, you know. And I never really thought it could get to that point. And, you know, it took years. I mean, I didn't quit my job for 5 years. You know, I was doing it in my apartment and in my house and, you know, staying up late and getting up early and filling orders and bringing them to my work to drop off at the post office and stuff and taking my lunch breaks so I could fill out international forms and stand in line at the post office. Like, it was a lot of work. And then one day you realize, you're like, oh, I think I could probably quit my job.
And that's a good feeling.
Yeah, it's a really good feeling.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, it's like it feels like that period from maybe, Rob, I mean, you were coming up the same way I was. It was like 2002 to like 2005, 2006, when a lot of us started just getting a little bit more legit.
Yeah.
You know, we were turning a hobby into something that was work and a source of income, you know.
Yeah, Shock Till You Drop.
Shock Till You Drop, Dread Central, you know, all of that stuff. So, you know, it's just fun to see that trajectory and see how it came up. What was the, you know, kind of, what was that feeling? I mean, obviously it was a good feeling to probably tell your day job, I'm sorry, I'm leaving. But obviously it had to have come with a little bit of stress, you know, once you actually did that. Was there a panic period where you were, for 2 weeks, you were like, oh my God?
A little bit. So, basically what happened was in 2007, you know, I started thinking about, because I just had my first child. So she was 6 months old, 7 months old. And I had a friend ask me, he's like, can't you be doing this full time now? And I was like, I never really thought about it. Like, I honestly didn't think, I was doing well enough, but I didn't know what that meant. Like, what does that mean? I can quit my job and do this full time. How do I figure that out? And I remember there was, you know, back then when online savings accounts were like literally 5% interest, which is ridiculous.
I know.
I signed up for one that had nothing to do with any bank that I was affiliated with. And I started having my weekly paycheck that I would make at my job, but I had that taken out of my Fright Rags money into that account, and I wouldn't even look at it. So I just wanted to see what would happen. The money's still there. It was just going to some other account. So I would just do that, and I would order shirts, and I would do this and do that. And then after about 6 months, I realized it hadn't affected my business whatsoever, taking that money out. And two, I had 6 months of income built up in an account somewhere making 5% interest. Yeah. And I thought, I think I can do this now. And I, even then, when I quit my job, I went part-time at a design job, a design firm downtown, which I ended up quitting after 3 months. I was working like 20 hours a week, but I was like, actually, I need this stop this and go do this full time because I need to just have Fright Racks be my entire attention.
And when did you start bringing on staffers?
And that was actually right around the time I quit my full time job and went part time at this design firm. One of my best friends, Tim, I was like, he just moved back into town and he needed some work, and he was working at a farm market like half the day. And I said, well, the first few hours a day that I'm gone, come over to my house and pack orders.
Right.
And I trusted him because he's one of my best friends. Yeah. So he would come over, and again, that was just sort of gradual. And then after a few months and a year, I'm like, oh, I guess maybe you can just be full time now. Like, it just, yeah, like all that stuff kind of just happened organically.
And at what point did, and I don't know if you can kind of shed light on this, but basically the way it works is if you want to do a known property, say like Halloween, for example, mm-hmm, which is currently, yeah, the month of Myers, right, and all that, you have to attain a license to produce shirts of that sort. So how does that work for somebody that knows nothing about t-shirts?
So in general, I mean, it's all different because every property is different. Every, you know, sometimes they're owned by studios. Sometimes they're owned by a dude who just has the rights to this thing. Mm-hmm. So you have to obviously find out who owns it. So in the case of Halloween, you know, you're looking at Compass, Trancas, International Pictures, and for the original Halloween, and you know, you have to make them a proposal, and generally it's in advance, so you have to pay a certain amount of money down up front, and then that's against royalties. So if your royalties are 10 or 12%, you know, you're paying in advance toward that, and then, you know, you just have to record sales. You usually get the license for about 2 years, and then you have to you record sales and give them a sales report every quarter. And if you make over your advance, then you got to start paying out per shirt, you know, per item. So yeah, it's it's funny that, again, happened organically, and we were doing small licenses that kind of get bigger and then bigger and bigger. And it seemed like for a long time, every license you get other stuff thrown at you. Like, then a licensor wants you to put them on your insurance for like $2 million. And I'm like, oh, that's a thing. I guess I got to do that and figure it out. And then it's like, yeah, oh, this person wants this. Oh, okay. That's a thing. Like, oh, wow. Like, and like, literally you're reading through 30 page documents going, holy shit, what am I getting myself into? But then you just dive in even further and make it work.
Yeah. No, it's been pretty great. We always ask to all the DVD labels, and so it may be a weird question, but what has been your bestseller, and what is the one thing that just barely sold it all?
Oh, man.
I mean, best and worst
there's
seller.
There's a lot of both. There's a lot of both.
A lot of both.
Yes, there's a lot of both. There's some that you just like, this is going to be awesome. It's going to be amazing. And you're just like, and just tanks, right, and you're like, uh-huh, what the hell? Like, there was a couple, I wouldn't say this is the worst bomb, I'm just trying to think off the top of my head. There was a couple Myers ones we did a few years ago, and even Halloween 3 ones. We had this one with Buddy kind of grabbing his head. I loved it because it was like the swirly design and everything, and that just didn't seem to pop. And I don't know what it was. Maybe it was released at the wrong time with the wrong stuff. You know, sometimes that can they can compete with each other, the shirts. But it just didn't – and then we had this really cool Myers one with the blood tears, and it was just like really interesting design. And I just – it just didn't do anything. Like, I was like, damn, this thing's cool. You know, I loved it. I thought it was great. I mean, ones that have done really great, honestly, the new 2018 Halloween shirt.
Yeah. You guys did a great job. I got my pins.
Oh, awesome.
The pins are amazing.
Thank you.
I really like the – if you guys go online, you can find all of our – all the pins. And my particularly favorite one is the pumpkin with the glitter. It's kind of like got a green glitter to it, which
is
kind of
cool. Yeah, we wanted to do something a little bit different with that symbol.
Yeah, that was fun. That was fun. But do you kind of research or customer feedback often? I mean, like, I remember – was there one time you did like kind of like a questionnaire or something like that? Or
we did. We did like – and this was – I don't know if this is what you're thinking of because it was years ago. It was you can help design a shirt. So
yes,
we had like questions.
That's it.
It was
that's
on our
it.
Old blog.
Yes, yes,
and
yes,
like we had like four things. And whoever got – you know, whatever sketch got the most votes, we went on to the color and
right,
all that.
Right, yes.
That is great. I mean, it's – you know, back then we were doing it unlicensed, so it's harder to do these days if we have to have approvals for things. It would be something I'd love to do again.
Yeah.
I mean, customer feedback, I mean, now with social media, it literally happens every second. I mean, all I have to do is open Instagram
Facebook,
and it's like, you guys got to do this or stop with all the Myers stuff or do this, more Jason.
Who says stop with all the Myers
dude,
stuff?
It's so funny. Like, we'll be so centric on one thing, like, Month of Myers, and everyone's like, and it's been going great, and everyone loves it, but then you see all these people like, too many Myers things, and I guarantee you, when we start selling out of that stuff and don't bring it back, you know, I mean, we're not going to bring it back in January, you know what I mean? Like, you need to have some time. But I guarantee you in January, someone's be like, do you ever do any Michael Myers stuff? And it's just like, oh my God. Like, you know, I get it. People find you different ways and different paths. But yeah, so customer feedback happens all the time. Right. So we're always listening to customers. I mean, you know, there's a lot of people like, do this. And then finally you're like, oh, cool. Now if we do it, there's actually a crowd there that's waiting for it.
One of the things I respect is just how self-made everything is. So what was the biggest learning curve for you? What was that one – what's that one thing that once you entered into this whole endeavor that you were just like, oh, my God, I don't know if I'm prepared for it, and that you learned as you went
and
you got better at as you went?
Licensing is probably the biggest headache.
Yeah.
Because you're dealing with – you know, in general, you're dealing with companies way larger than you are, and they're dealing with companies way larger than you are. So, I mean, Universal is dealing with us just like they're dealing with a company that's selling 20,000 units to Hot Topic.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? Like, or bigger properties, you know? Mm-hmm. We're all lumped in together in a way. You know, there's one licensing department. So that was a steep learning curve because there's so much thrown at you, and you think you're doing it right, and then you get an email saying, you can't do that, or you need to stop selling that stuff right now because this didn't happen. And you're like, what? No, we crossed our T's and dotted our I's. What happened? Like, there's been times, no joke, where we've been asked to stop selling stuff that actually was approved.
What?
Yeah.
That's crazy.
And it's like, well, what do you mean? And they're like, well, actually, and they screwed up, but we have all this inventory that we can't do anything with now.
Wow.
So, I mean...
So what do you do with that stuff then?
I mean, you try to negotiate other things in the contract, right, and extensions or whatever. I mean, that stuff you just end up having to like donate or something or just get rid of somehow.
Man.
And that does happen. And whatever, everyone makes mistakes. I'm not, you know, complaining or blaming anybody, but these are things that you go through that I feel like, you know, once, twice, three times a month, you know, you're opening your email going, oh, okay.
Right.
Like, no joke, we're doing Die Hard and we can't use the building.
Yeah.
We can't use the likeness of the building.
Nakatomi Plaza is off limits.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Because, I mean, and fair enough, you know, they told us that we had to go through the building over, and that's an owner, and that's fine. No, not a problem, but they didn't, the building owner didn't want us to do anything
with
it.
That's a weird thing you just never would think of.
I'm just trying to illustrate that point. Yeah. Like, we get that we have to work around likenesses all the time. That's a problem sometimes, but it's also a creative something that we work around, and we know this going into a lot of these licenses. You can't use this person's face. Okay, fine. No problem. But now we can't use the building, and you're just like, oh, wow, okay, that got weird.
You know what I mean? Weird.
But again, that's just things that I don't say – again, I don't say those things to complain or like whine about. It's just like those are the realities that we're dealing with because you get a lot of this customer feedback saying, well, why didn't you do this? Why didn't you do this? We would have.
Yeah.
We can't, literally. So we just have to work around it.
I'm currently looking up the Die Hard Blu-ray and just seeing on the covers if any of them have represented the building.
I'm very curious. You know, it's interesting. There's actually been buildings used in some posters and things that I believe, well, I mean, as far as I know, were licensed. So I don't know what happened in that time frame.
Yeah.
But we did, you know, and Fox is great. I mean, they gave us the building owner's, you know, phone number and everything, and they were great to talk to us. They just said, no, it's just not something we want you to do. And it was up to them to say no, and that's fine. It was just one of those things where you're like, oh, shit.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's like a key piece.
Yeah. I mean, if you really break it down in that movie, it's the building and Bruce Willis, and you can't use either of them. You're like, okay.
Right.
So we're just trying to be really creative. But honestly, in that process, we've come up with some interesting ideas. And I've looked at a couple of things that we're doing. There's a couple more we want to do for the 30th anniversary this year that's going to have to get moved to next year. But the first collection is coming out next month. And I dig it. I dig the direction. I'm feeling it because it's nothing I've seen before in this thing. So I'm like, to me, it's pushing us to be better.
Oh, cool. Yeah, yeah. And it's fun because I'm a big Teen Wolf fan, obviously, as you are.
Yeah.
And Chris, who's one of the guys from your company, was kind enough to consistently ask me a lot of questions as a fan, like, what do you think about this design, or should we do this or that, or would you buy that shirt? And so I was happy to be an unofficial.
Absolutely.
Consultant.
No, we do that, especially if we know somebody is like a total fan. Like, obviously, I'm a huge fan of it too, but if somebody else can have like an outside like view on it,
right,
you know, like there are people in, like Jess is a huge fan of Creepshow. It's like, all right, Jess, she actually caught a flub on one of our shirts. And I was like, oh, shit, you know? So like, you know, we have to have that kind of, you know, backup whenever we can get it.
Yeah.
What, you know, I'm noticing that the selection process of properties that you're going after has varied much more over the years. So talk us through that kind of that process? Is it a collective decision? Is it your decision? You know, you talk about Die Hard, which I would never have expected from Fright Rags. But you also have that – what's the avenue for other kind of stuff like The Running Man?
Plastic Fang.
Plastic Fang. Yeah. So, I mean, like, who makes those decisions? When, you know, is it just passion for a particular project or what?
It's a lot of – little things. So some of it's my decision. Like, I just want to do this and I think it'd be cool to pursue it if we can get it. Sometimes it's other people in the company that's saying, you know, oh, we should try to look into this. Sometimes it's really looking at a studio's catalog and saying, you know, okay. Because honestly, you know, I get when people ask us to do some more obscure things and whatnot, and we do try, but some of the more obscure things are obscure for a reason because you can't find who owns it.
Right.
So in some cases, we're just, you know, a lot of people might complain that we're doing too much of these types of properties, but I'm like, well, A, people love them, and B, like, this is what we like, and also, like, if we could do some of these obscure ones, maybe we would, given the right opportunity. So when we look at, like, a studio catalog and we go, oh, man, they've got this, it's like it's like a kid in a candy store.
Yeah.
So, you know, for instance, Universal, you know, they're great to us, and Fox as well, and we work with MGM and Paramount, and like for a company like Fox or Universal, you know, we'll look at their properties and go, oh man, like I want to do that. Yeah, like Die Hard, or we're doing Edward Scissorhands. We're actually going to be doing Home Alone.
Oh wow.
Yeah. So I mean, talk about not horror, but it's stuff that it starts getting me sort of excited to create, you know, when you think of something, go, ooh, you know, I want to do something for that. Let's do it. So there's a lot of that, I think. And even like with Universal, there's a couple properties. We just renewed a deal with them and we added a ton of properties, which I'll tell you guys off the air because I think you'll be interested in some of them. But I don't want to say too much now, but basically they didn't know they owned some of these movies.
Oh, wow.
And I was like, hey, do you own this? And they're like, let me find out. And then like a day later, like, yep, we do. I'm like, well, add it to the list. It was like this to-do list that I just kept going and going and going. And finally, like, we've got this 25 property list that we're just going to go nuts with. So,
how far in advance is your Fright Rag slate? Like, at this point, what shirts are you working for? Is it for summer of next year already?
So I do this thing sometimes because we have all these licenses and they all end at certain times, and some we're going to renew and some we're not, and some we have to do more with and some we haven't done enough with yet. So I literally sat down a couple months ago and I just took index cards and started writing titles on them, the ones that we had and ones that we needed to do more with. And I just made a stack. I just kept going on and just to mind dump. Mm. And I had a stack of 70 cards for next year.
Wow.
Just for 2019. So that's, if you figure a release a week, that's more than one a week.
Yeah.
And so we mapped them all out for the entire year. And we even got plans into 2020. Now that's going to change. Like, we just found out, Happy Death Day 2 is coming out in February, so we're moving our Happy Death Day collection up to February.
Is that a scoop?
That's a scoop.
That's a scoop to me.
Yeah, it's a scoop. It's
Happy
a total
Death
scoop.
Day, Die Hard, Home Alone. Got it.
So we'll move things around, but that literally, we have a huge bulletin board where we have all these tacked up and we can just look at them for the year and just kind of feel it out. It's like making a playlist. You know, you got to ebb and flow. It's sort of like, all right, what do we want to do next? What makes sense to do? Have we done this before? Should we do this now? That type of thing.
Right. Wow. Happy Death Day.
It's crazy. I was shocked when there was a sequel. When I heard
we're done.
I was like, Ryan, is there really a sequel coming out? He's like,
we're done. Movie's almost done. And it's great. I have a quick question for you. I mean, like, what's the ultimate goal? What is that ultimate pie in the sky for you in terms of Fright Rags as a brand and as a merchandiser? Is it to do... Like, I imagine Fright Rags one day going to San Diego Comic-Con and having the ultimate pop-up shop. Like, having enough stuff there. Kind of like what Super 7 does, you know?
Yeah.
Where it's like, they just move in. They, you know, this year they had the Universal Monsters collection. They just did something cool. I mean, is it pop-up shop that leads to a full store? I mean, what do you think?
I think, I mean, actually, just you saying that right there is actually... I would love to do that. I haven't really gotten
my head around. Ryan.
Yeah. So, Ryan, that's exactly what I was thinking.
Go for it.
No, honestly, I haven't really wrapped my head around the concept of doing just an actual store because to me that's a lot of work. And not that that's like something I don't want to do. It's like that's such a different beast and it can only survive somewhere here.
Right.
In LA.
Right. Yeah.
Like that, and so then there's the logistics of that, right?
For sure.
To me, though, to your point, because I actually have talked to mutual friends of ours of doing a pop-up shop, that is something that I would love to do, and I'd love to go to San Diego Comic-Con, and I'd love to have more of a presence in these places with more stuff
right.
to kind of meet the crowd's demand for all the stuff. I mean, again, Teen Wolf really isn't a horror movie other than that he's a werewolf, but I loved that growing up, and I wanted to do shirts for it, you know? So, yes, horror is always going to be our bread and butter. I don't see that ever going away, but I want to dabble in these other genres, and I want to just be a house for all those things.
Yeah. I'm just curious about kind of – I mean, you listen all the time, obviously, and you and I both have a love and affinity for 3D, mm-hmm. although you've sold out to me and went 4K.
I'm still going 3D. I still got 3D.
but you have your own home theater set up and all that kind of stuff. What have you been watching lately? Because obviously that's how we kick off the show every week, is talking about what we've seen lately. What's been exciting for you as a horror fan since, you know, what's been speaking to you lately?
Well, one that I haven't seen yet but I want to see is Revenge. It's been on my list for a while to see. I did see Extremity a couple weeks ago.
Hey.
Yeah.
Thanks.
I did. I liked it a lot. That was really cool, and it's funny because it was
and Blu-ray,
you know, and it was actually before John was on your show, but I thought it was great, sort of watching that after seeing Haunters and seeing that sort of the way they fit together.
Yeah,
I thought it was really great.
It's a great chaser to that documentary.
Yeah, totally
for sure.
Great. One I do want to talk about is Doom Asylum, because I did.
That's a Shockwaves.
Yeah,
the thing that threw you over the
approved
edge. Right?
Shockwaves
is
approved by one.
It is.
No, Shockwaves approved by one. By one, that's me.
It was Elric talked about it, I talked about it, and then somehow Ryan talked about it, and when Ryan talked about it is when everyone bought it. And we're like, we tried to warn you. You had three reviews. So anyway, Doom Asylum, what's your stance on this movie?
Oof.
I
said, I don't know if it's a movie I love to hate or hate to love, and I think I kind of love it.
You do love it.
Because it's just one of those movies.
It's so
like,
weird.
I'm just watching it going, is this really happening? And that one chick's like, she keeps like laughing. And I'm just like, these are all memes. It's just like one long meme.
She laughs like, is it Phyllis Diller in Mad Monster Party?
Oh, man.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, my God. It's exactly like that. So, yeah, I watched that recently. God, what else have I seen? I almost have to pop out my list.
While you do that, I want to hear about you have your own home theater now, don't you?
Oh my God.
I remember when you
the
were
glory days.
Yeah, I remember seeing your Instagram or your social media feed, and you're like, I'm moving into this new place. I got a nice new theater. And I was like, oh, I'm so jealous.
Yeah. Hard to have those here in Los Angeles.
Yeah, it's honestly, it's so awesome because, like, for instance, my wife and I missed Deadpool 2 in the theaters. Mm-hmm. We just didn't get a chance to see it and we've been dying to see it, but, you know, getting a sitter for the kids and all the whole thing.
Oh, yeah.
And so, you know, I just waited to, it came out on Blu-ray in 4K, and I got it, and we, you know, it was like a Tuesday night, and we just went in the theater and watched it, and it was better than watching it in the movie theater.
Yeah.
Like, to me, I mean, obviously, of course, there's the experience of watching a movie with people, and there's a communal aspect that's why we do screenings every month at a local theater. Like, I want to share a movie with people, but in general, I also like being at home, and you know, I can pause it to go to the bathroom or get another beer, and I'm in a room where I can just focus on the movie and not idiots around me.
Yeah.
Yes. So. And subtitles as well. I need to read everything, so I don't miss anything.
Nice.
Tell us a little bit about the screening series that you did. Where did it get its start? Where is it held?
So we hold it at a local art house theater. It's a historic art house theater in Rochester. It's called The Little. And we started working with them about 10 years ago. We did a 24-hour horror movie fest, and we helped sponsor it and helped program it, and it was great. And then the next year we did another one. And then since then we had been in contact with the lead projectionist, and we started doing screenings, I don't know, once, twice a year, usually around October time, of course. Sometimes it was earlier in the year, and we could get like someone to Skype in. Like, we'd show Friday 13th Part 2, and I know Amy Steele, so I could Skype her in. Or, you know, it was just – these things just kind of happened.
Yeah.
And so in 2016, we decided to kind of get our heads, collective heads together, a couple of the guys from The Little and us from Fright Rags. And that's what we call Saturday Night Rewind, because it's on Saturdays.
Yeah.
And almost all of our showings are film where we can do it, so original prints. And we just – you know, we just want to show movies and have, it's like a party every month. We just have people coming out And it's just great. It's great to have it in Rochester because obviously LA, you've got the new Bev, you've got all these places that do these things all the time. And yeah, there was Jeff Meyer did a great one in Syracuse, which is great, which isn't too far. And then there's, you know, there's Exhumed, which is a little further, you know, it's all that stuff in New York. And I kind of wanted to be able to go see a movie and then be home in like 10 minutes, like selfishly. Like, and I knew the fans were in Rochester. I knew there were fans there.
And do you have regulars?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, we get regulars. We have people coming from, you know, hour, 2 hours, 3 hours away just to see the shows. So, it, you know, it's one of those things now. It's a platform. So every month we get to do something interesting. Like usually in October we do every weekend. A couple years ago we had Joe Bob Briggs come up.
Nice.
And we built, my brother and I built a facade of a trailer and we had a whole set up on a stage.
What? Really?
So, yeah.
That's great.
So he could do the intro to Warriors and then we did a Q&A up there and we had PJ Souls out last year. Yeah. And so, I mean, we just try to mix it up and do just have fun with it.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Now, how many people do you have on your staff? You're still relatively small, right?
Yeah, we are 7 total.
That's incredible. And it's a warehouse or is it?
It's like office / warehouse. It's actually the old morgue in downtown Rochester.
Of course.
Yeah.
That's
well,
awesome.
I mean.
How'd you come upon that?
It wasn't planned. We were at what our second office and we were running out of space. Our lease was up. I really did not like the landlord. I did not want to stay there. It was not just not conducive to being there for much longer. So I was looking for spaces and I kept looking around town and I didn't really want anything like strip mall cookie cutter stuff. So I was looking around. This one place kept opening up on my search and I was like, man, this place is gorgeous. Where is this? And it's in like the Cascade District, historic district, downtown Rochester. And I'm like, I don't even know where this is. I mean, I knew it on a map, but I had never been down this one street and it was a little out of my price range. And I thought, let's just check it out. I need to check this out, get it off my mind.
Right.
And I walked in there. I'm like, oh my God, this place is gorgeous. The offices upstairs were awesome. The warehouse was great. It was huge. It was really kind of a cool area of town. And it looked like a back lot, like a studio back lot. That's, like when you go down the street, it's like a...
Just that character.
It's just character.
Yeah.
And so the landlord was like, yeah, it used to be the old morgue. And I was like, what? And he's like, yeah, it was the old city morgue. This is where the autopsy room was and blah. And this is the drain where they drained all the bodily fluids and blah, blah. And I was like, holy shit. Okay, like I need to be here, but what can you do on the rent? And it's funny, that design job I had taken after I left my full-time job, I was at a lunch with we were designing a book for a local theater, and I was at a lunch with a few of the people helping with the book, and there was this photographer there. Well, that photographer ended up being this building owner.
Oh wow.
So nice. I was burned by my old landlord, so I was like, I don't know if I want to enter a deal with this guy. He was burned by his old tenant because they ditched him.
Right.
And meanwhile, my employer, you know, my former employer, the design firm, she was like, oh, no, guess what? Andy and Ben, you guys are great. So you should work together.
Yeah,
and I was
wow.
like, oh, my God, this is awesome.
Yeah.
And it's been like complete love fest ever since because we've been there just over 5 years now. But it's great. It's not ideal for certain things like deliveries and stuff because we are down like this alley and it's not like we have some huge loading dock, you
right.
know. And it is Rochester, so we get like, you know, feet of snow, and so it can be a little bit hard. But honestly, the advantages far outweigh the disadvantages. Especially,
yeah.
I mean, yeah, it's the old morgue. So what more could you want?
Do you throw Halloween parties on there?
We do office Halloween parties. We're actually thinking about doing like almost like a flea market thing.
Yeah,
like have like a tables out and just sell stuff, and
that'd be great.
Or just have like, we're actually also talking about having like a block party and just like closing off part of the street and just
a little
like
VHS swap.
Ooh, that'd be
good. Slashback out
I
there.
Like that. Oh yeah.
All right.
That's
Ben and Ben and Fright Rags were very kind of co-sponsor Slashback Video, and they are now our exclusive T-shirt.
I am planning a trip eventually to come see it.
Please do.
Because it's been a long time since I spent time on that coast. And it just seems like I want to see the offices. I want to go to one of your screenings. Yeah. I want to see the home theater.
Yeah.
So I think we'd have
make a weekend of it. We got space to come stay with me and just hang out.
That's the magic word I was waiting for.
Just do it. I got a whole wing.
Cut 2 months later and it's all four of us.
Right?
Elric,
Shockwaves
Rebecca,
is now being recorded.
Yeah, that's pretty funny. Well, very cool. We've had a lot going on this week with Beyond Fest. Stay tuned. We have a bonus episode from Beyond Fest coming your way, Halloween centric. I only have one real movie that I wanted to talk about that I've seen in the last week, and that is Tales from the Hood 2.
I saw you post this on Instagram. And
I was very excited. Yeah, well, and the thing is this. So I love Tales from the Hood. It is one of those underrated gems from the mid-90s. When it comes to horror anthologies, I think it's one of the best out there. I also love the filmmakers. Darren Scott has been a longtime friend, and he's been on the show a lot, and he's just a super talented guy that's done so many different things within the genre, outside of the genre. I just have a lot of respect for him, and it just seems like what they you know, when Scream Factory did that Tales from the Hood Blu-ray, and a lot more people got to discover it, and especially, I mean, Get Out was a big part of that kind of storytelling being, you know, kind of visible again.
Right.
But from 1995, that movie is still relevant.
Oh, for sure.
It still pushes a lot of buttons. And it's a shame that we didn't get more of them, quite frankly. Because here are two guys, Darren and his partner, Rusty Cundiff, who had a lot to say about from the black perspective. And so I was always hoping they would do a sequel, and they finally did, which I have to believe is probably because of something like Get Out being as successful as it is. Now, I'll preface by saying that obviously this is a much more low-budget affair than the original because it's a completely different time period. That said, I really kind of was blown away by this movie. I think it's some of this – there's, I think, four segments in a wraparound. It's the satire. So some of the segments are really fun, but when they get dark, it's really dark. And it's interesting because the way it worked this time, I didn't know until the credits popped up for the segments, is that Darren directed half of them and Rusty directed the other half. And so Darren's are very much Darren. They're fun. They're a little over the top. One of his segments is kind of like an internet dating thing gone wrong. The other one is brilliant, basically about a bunch of gangsters that accidentally kill a competitor who they're trying to extort and find out where he's hiding all this money. And then one of them just sees on TV, like one of these guys that pretends to talk to mediums. They're like, let's just get that guy to communicate with him so he could figure out where he hit. And it's just like absolute blast, really fun. And then the stuff that Rusty does is, I mean, not even just it's very obviously about the politics that are happening now. The through line in between story is a little on the goofy side, but it is so aimed at the current administration. And it gets – they're really dark. One is a killer doll thing, and the other really affected me emotionally because it basically was retelling the Emmett Till story while juxtaposing a new story on top of it. And I mean, there's no time period where that Emmett Till story won't affect you as a human being, how awful it is. So I was kind of blown away. There's almost like two juggling tones here where they're keeping it fun and then all of a sudden they're hitting you with something that's so like deep that you can't help but be like, Jesus Christ, you know, like this is pretty tough. And so in that regard, I love the movie. By the way, Keith David is the main guy in it. I forget his name, the character's name, but he's basically the host. And so getting to hear him do the whole, you know, welcome to hell, motherfucker, which you have to expect. So I really love this movie. It's funny because I bought the Blu-ray right away because Universal did this one.
Yeah.
It just popped up on Netflix, so it actually is on Netflix now.
Oh, interesting.
But it's funny because I've heard of – I don't know if it's just people are – to me, story trumps all, and it just seems like – I noticed a little activity in the group today saying that, you know, kind of mixed about it. And I don't know if it's because of the multiple tones. I don't know if it's because – I mean, look, it's 23 years later. Obviously, it was shot digitally. It has a slightly different look. But I think the stories are strong enough, and I actually tweeted this. I hope Jordan Peele is paying attention because these are the guys that should be doing Twilight Zone or at least get a crack at it because it obviously seems like they have a lot of stories left to tell specifically from that black point of view.
Yeah.
So I enjoyed Tales from the Hood 2 tremendously. And if you have Netflix, there's very little gamble to just watch it on Netflix. So that's my take.
Nice.
Ooh, that's great.
Have either of you guys been watching American Horror Story Apocalypse?
No, I got to catch up.
So after kind of a dry spell of American Horror Story, I didn't watch the last season. Mm-hmm. And I ducked out of this, not hotel, but the one before that. And with the promise that this one was going to bring together my favorite season, which is Murder House, and then the other favorite season, which is Coven.
Are the only two I've seen, by the way.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And they are great.
They're very good. And in fact, I started rewatching Murder House, and you strip away the kind of American Horror Story banner, and it just stands on its own as just a really great, crazy horror tale.
Oh, it's great.
I mean, it's really it's highly rewatchable. This, you know, Dylan McDermott story, Connie Britton, you know, family drama works really well. Jessica Lange is fantastic in it. Anyways, Murder House is phenomenal. Apocalypse, after kind of a shaky first episode where I didn't really know where it was going, because it literally ends with the end, you know, begins with the end of the world, with a full on nuclear strike on America and just like the world being obliterated and, you know, a nuclear holocaust. This select group of individuals are brought underground, and they're run by basically this matriarchy, and they've got very specific plans for all of these people. But what it's boiling down to is a story of witches versus warlocks. So it's the witches of Coven versus these warlocks who have been able to survive the apocalypse, and they're being led by the offspring of Connie Britton and Tate. Not Dylan McDermott. No, because remember at the end of Murder House?
Yeah, oh, my God. It's
It wasn't Dylan's baby.
Yeah,
or somebody,
yeah.
It was Tate's. So it's that boy all grown up, and he might be Satan. And
is he in it? Or is Connie Britton in it?
So apparently Connie, Dylan, everybody's back, but they're slowly rolling them out. Yeah. But it's very, very amusing. I'm having a great time. Emma Roberts just came back, and it's a fun time so far. I mean, like, they did this whole before the nukes fell kind of backstory as to where all the witches have been up, what they've been up to, you know, and what their kind of relationship with the warlocks and stuff. And it's very interesting, very, very fun stuff. So I think American Horror Story is kind of back on track. It's not scary per se, but if you really love Murder House and Coven, then you'll definitely love the kind of tonal blend that you get. So it's good stuff.
Cool. They're all on Netflix, and I only seen some seasons.
I got to brush up on a lot of that.
Yeah. I mean, it's every time I see it, it's cool. Yeah. Because they seem to throw every horror thing you can think
there.
Of in
yeah,
it.
Yeah.
Which is kind of neat.
And the remarkable thing is this actually feels focused.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it actually feels like they're very focused in terms of telling a very specific story. I'm wondering where it's all going to lead to, but it's cool.
I've been wanting to make a suggestion to you, Ryan, for the last several episodes since I was in Europe. he's already smirking at me with that Ryan look. It's not that crazy. Here's the thing. When I was in France, I was looking for something on Netflix to watch with my girlfriend, and we landed on Scream, the MTV series, which it's weird because they did the two seasons. They shot a third season. Apparently, it has nothing to do with the other two, but it's never come out. Yeah. I don't know what's going on with that. But anyway, the point being is I love the series as it aired. I love the score. We had John Carner on the show, but I haven't revisited it since. And now we've had things like Riverdale, which I think is terrific. And a lot of the TV landscape has changed a little bit to become a little more horror-centric. And so I was kind of blown away because I was watching it through my girlfriend's eyes for the first time. And, you know, we watched like four or five episodes. And I was kind of blown away by like how much like Wes was a little ahead of the curve with the movies, especially four. Scream 4 I didn't like. I think Scream 4 right now is so perfect.
Yeah.
I think he was just 10 years ahead again.
Oh, big time.
I feel kind of the same way about the show because I enjoyed the show 10 times more revisiting it now. And I know that for you, Scream is a special place in your heart because you did the doc and you love the original movies and you weren't that into the show. But my request or challenge to you is I think you should give it another shot on Netflix, especially now in light of those shows I mentioned and things like Happy Death Day and Truth or Dare, like kind of those teen things that came after the Scream show.
I'll give it a shot.
I kind of think it's totally in line with those, and it kind of paved the way for things like
Riverdale. That was only, what, 4 years ago?
About three or four years ago,
Yeah, 3-4 years ago.
They did two seasons and a Halloween special, and the Halloween special is on Netflix as well. So you can literally watch the entire story play out, which I thought was pretty cool.
Yeah, I'll give it a shot. I've been curious. It's been in my feed. Mm. Like, I mean, it's on my list, and I always kind of thumb over and go, do I want to get committed to that?
I think you do, especially considering some of the films this fine establishment has put out in the last year.
For sure. Mind you, I haven't been able to fully commit to Riverdale. I got about halfway through. It's just not for me. I mean, it's really – every time I try to hold out for some really crazy shit, I need to wade through a lot of stuff I really don't care about. That's why I'm super excited for Sabrina on Netflix. Yeah.
That looks great.
The trailer looks like my jam. The billboards are all up around town, and it's totally up my alley, so I'm very excited about
that. When does that come out?
26th, I think. Yeah. Something like that.
Yeah, it's towards the end of the month.
I'm really curious, though. I mean, like, one thing I'm concerned about is it's probably hyper-stylized just for the trailer, but there's, like, this kind of weird Instagram filter they threw on the trailer where everything is super blurred around the edges, and I'm like, please don't be that whole show. Don't do that.
Well, a week before it premieres, you can talk to one of the writers on the show about it, and we'll ask
her. That's right. She's listening now, and she's like, Ryan, come on. Yeah, but all right, I'll give Scream a shot. I'll give it a shot. A
couple of quick plugs before we pull our guest in and hear from our sponsors again. But this weekend, the reason that Ben's in town with Fright Rags is the Halloween 40th Anniversary Convention, which is happening in Pasadena, California at the Pasadena Convention Center. It's October 12th through the 14th, so the day that this airs, it is kicking off. Go to Halloween40.com for all the details. Shockwaves, all four of us, I think, are doing a panel on Saturday at 2 p.m.
Yep.
Obviously, Ryan's going to be there for the new Halloween. And I think you and I are moderating a few panels on top of, you're not. I am. I am on, as well as Brian Collins and I believe Steve Barton, aka Uncle Creepy.
Oh, cool.
We're going to be there all weekend. Fright Rags will be there all weekend. So come out to the Halloween convention. And also, if you're local and you like art and you want to check it out for free, my friends over at Hyena Gallery in Burbank are doing all month, they're doing Nightmare on Elm Street 3 Dream Warriors tribute show, which is kind of already seen a lot of the pieces and they're pretty awesome. But this Friday, when this airs, the 12th, is their reception that night. And they've got a couple of the Dream Warriors that are going to pop over there. So Ken Sagos is one of them. I can't remember who else. But yeah, it's just cool. I think you should pop in if you're in Burbank tonight.
And if you want to drive up the street, we won't be open tonight, but we'll be open all through the weekend as Slashback Video within the Mystic Museum. If you still haven't checked it out or caught it yet, please do so. It'll be running now until the end of the year.
Right.
It's going to go all the way through the end of the year.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. That's amazing. Yeah.
Because people are coming. Yeah. It's insane, guys. Rachel True from The Craft came in.
Yeah.
Fruza Balk.
Yeah, Fruza Balk.
From The Craft
came in. Who else? We've been getting a lot of people just kind of rolling through and taking pictures with their tapes, which is insane.
Bring quarters, and you could play Splatterhouse, which I did. And there's also a Nintendo in the corner. I played Friday the 13th on Nintendo.
Same Splatterhouse from last year?
Yeah.
Nice.
We own that now.
Oh, that's true. It's pretty terrific.
Yeah. Curtis from Creature Feature, he refurbished that thing, and we just bought it off him.
It's beautiful.
That's great.
Yeah. All right, so check out this thing. Let's hear from our sponsors, and we got a really rad guest coming on momentarily.
Fright Rags is your number one source for horror t-shirts. With specially curated collections created by renowned horror artists, they offer the best art and the best quality anywhere. They are back just in time for Halloween. All the General Mills monsters are back with shirts, pins, and more. Get your Frankenberry, Booberry, Fruit Brute, Yummy Mummy, and Count Chocula merch while you can. Try to say all that five times fast. Also currently, Fright Rags is celebrating a month of Myers with all new assorted Halloween t-shirts, pins, and more. Look for the Ad Nauseam book and t-shirt combo, the Trick or Treat collection, and the amazing Stephen King birthday collection. They've got you fully clothed for the Halloween season. So head on over to fright-rags.com now, and you can enter the code SUMMERSHOCK10. It's fall time now, but you can use SUMMERSHOCK10 at checkout to get 10% off your entire order. Again, it's SUMMERSHOCK10, so head on to fright-rags.com now for all the good stuff.
Fangoria is back. Resurrected just in time for this Halloween, the magazine that set the standard is back as a deluxe 100-page quarterly edition. Featuring the much-anticipated Halloween sequel, the new issue features set visits, deep dives, new discoveries, fiction, and exclusive artwork. Check it out now. But it's not just a magazine anymore. Fangoria is also bringing you novels under its Fangoria Presents label, and Fango is also getting into the movie biz. Be sure to check out their recent release, Puppet Master: The Littlest Reich. Head on over to Fangoria.com and subscribe
to Fangoria now. Subscription is $60 and will save you about $20 off the cover price. Worth every penny. I got one right here in front of me.
I love
it. Fangoria.com. Subscribe now. Okay, and welcome back to the show. I'm very excited about this guest, although I don't know for sure if you have or have not done podcasts. I think you may have, but not known that it was a podcast.
No, I don't know. I can't recall, I guess.
I want to say this is one of your first podcast appearances, and it was because of our mutual friend Craig Perry, so I got to give him a shout out.
The great Craig.
The great Craig Perry. And we're joined by screenwriter Andrew Kevin Walker.
Yeah,
hello.
He's
already sighing and making a no face to me. But
listen, this is a bucket list thing.
It is. And
I mean, there are two screenwriters in film school that were a big deal to me, and that was Andrew Kevin Walker and Kevin Williamson.
Oh. Mm.
And I was like, when
the Kevins.
Yeah.
The Kevins.
But the two Kevins. There's something. We need to talk about Kevin. welcome, man.
Welcome.
Thank you very much.
And one of the first things that I emailed you about, because it was we met over the weekend briefly just to get to know each other a little bit, and it was true. I spent 7 years of my life working for a little company called Tower Records.
Tower Records.
Back in New York. And part of the folklore when you worked in the video department at Tower Records was, hey, man, I heard the dude that wrote Seven wrote it while working at Tower Records. And so I understood because I dealt with the customers in New York. And so when I emailed you, I said, was that true?
And it was true.
The one on 4th Street?
That's what people assume, that I was at the cool Tower
Records.
But I was at – I mean, I loved it. It was the 66th and Broadway Tower, right across from Lincoln Center, which
was also
sad
cool.
That they're gone.
Yeah, I know.
We were talking about they're still in Japan and in Dublin.
Yeah.
Wow.
But none here. We still have
Amoeba.
Yeah, we do. But you also wrote Brain Scan while working at Tower. Tower is a very –
well, I can tell the story of that, but that was before Tower.
Oh, okay.
Please do.
Right, yeah.
I'm curious.
Well, okay. So I'll tell
you. I just watched Brain Scan like 3 weeks ago, so I'm very curious.
Of course you did, because it's spectacularly now on Blu-ray.
Yeah.
Yep. Scream Factory.
Not one residual to me, because it was non-signatory Writers Guild. It's heartbreaking. I studied film at Penn State. I moved to New York. I worked for really, really low-budget companies in New York, like I was saying to you. Lower than Tyson. I mean, lower than Troma. And one of the companies was named Tyson. And the one of the other companies that I worked for was called Bryson Entertainment. I don't know why they always had to have Sun in them. But that's the ones. They had an office at Kaufman Astoria Studio. I was kind of PAing for them, and eventually I wrote Brain Scan for them. They worked on – you know, look, this is the go-go days of, if you made a movie, it didn't matter how low the cost was. If you put it on VHS and put a box around it, you could sell it in all these video stores and 7-Eleven racks that were renting VHS. So there was so much stuff getting made, low-budget stuff in New York, horror stuff. The company I was working for had things they were working on, ideas like Blood Rush, which was murders at a fraternity house, and Abusement Park was one of the ideas, which was people being killed at an amusement park, like a razor-thin wire being put across where the roller coaster goes, so a lot of heads would be all lopped off at once. Brain Scan was one that I wrote the script for them, and my parents actually – you know, treated my 5 years in New York like more college. So they paid actually for like 3 months of my life while I wrote that script. But anyway, yes, I wrote it. That company went out of business. And then years later, to my surprise, someone had bought them. But the whole – bought it and made it out of the – whatever was left of the bankruptcy of this company. Mm-hmm. It was specifically because I wanted to write that I went and started working at Tower Records, because for the times when my parents weren't paying for my life, I didn't have any time to write when I was a PA on a, you know, like a 60-hour work week was just too much. So 40 hours at Tower was what saved me time to write. And I would say in the morning, but never in the morning. I never got up at night. And then I did, you know, I worked at Tower for 3 years. Every week that I was there, I thought, oh, this is my last week there from the very get-go. But I wrote 7 while I was working at Tower.
Wow. And was writing always the passion? Is that what you always knew you wanted to do?
I really fixated on writing at Penn State. I had an amazing screenwriting teacher, Jeff Rush, who teaches at Temple now. You know, because Penn State didn't have, you know, all the advantages of proximity to the biz that obviously NYU and UCLA and USC have and had. So I probably started out thinking, oh, yeah, I want to direct, but I really focused on screenwriting because of certain weird things. I was able to write a feature-length script at Penn State in the film program rather than the short film, and that was incredibly helpful in learning because I am a big structuralist. I believe in three-act structure, et cetera.
Right. Well, the first thing you're credited as writing is Brain Scan, but you also have a Tales from the Crypt episode and obviously Seven. Did you grow up a genre fan? Or was that kind of where you fell into? Like, when did you fall in love with horror movies?
I loved it from a very young age. You know, the big ones for me, or one of the biggest ones for me, was Dawn of the Dead. You know, I'm from Pennsylvania, suburban Pennsylvania, and midnight movies were a huge thing. You know, Pink Flamingos and Dawn of the Dead. You know, I remember, oh, what? It doesn't have a rating? That's how horrifying it is? It can't even be rated X? And then coincidentally, since those movies were out of Pittsburgh, one of the few people who came to Penn State, I remember, to kind of speak to the classes was Tom Savini.
Oh.
And that was huge for me. Like, he was one of the people I cornered at Monsterpalooza recently and made him sign a – you know, I mean, I paid him.
Yeah.
But I had him sign a Dawn of the Dead poster, which is hanging proudly in my house now. But, yeah, I mean, I loved horror. I think for me it was like – because I was so into the nuts and bolts of filmmaking – that I loved the horror movies and then you know, Cine Fantastique and all kind of looking into how the special effects were done. And that's why Savini was and is an obsession, et cetera. You know, I loved horror stuff. And it was only later that the art and craft of writing kind of came to me in college. But it was a great time, you know, to love horror in the 80s, you know.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we're still – I mean, I'm holding a Fangoria in front of me, which we thankfully got to grow up with.
I was going
to
say, it sounded like there's some time passed between the time that you originally wrote Brain Scan and then the time it was made. Was there much updating to do in terms of technology, or was that just a short period?
I mean, when you watched it, like, you see, like, it – you know, it was kind of – I mean, they did a great job, I thought. Yeah. It was a widescreen TV and – you know, I mean, that was kind of ahead of its time, even when they made it, like the idea of that aspect ratio. You know,
or even just the notion of a CD-ROM.
Yeah, not that much time had passed, but enough years where I was like, Seven hadn't been made yet and didn't seem like it had any chance of being made. So, as I've said, kind of in the interview that's on the disc for Brain Scan, for all I knew, Tales from the Crypt had probably come out, and so I had one credit to my name at least, and that was great. It had been kind of – that was the Martin Sheen episode, and it kind of been pretty well rewritten, but it was still super exciting to see my name on something. Brain Scan, as far as I knew, was going to be my only feature credit ever, and I was like so excited and happy. Now, I always like to bend over backwards to say whether you can call it taking credit for or not – I don't want to try and act like – and by the way, I created the – you know, I always say the Trickster, and I'm always corrected by my friend David Kessler. It's just Trickster. And when I wrote the script, the big change from the script to the screen, the silver screen that Brain Scan ended up on, is that the – that Trickster was just a voice on the phone. So it was like you would put it in and then your phone would ring and then you'd get this kind of mind fuck from this right. voice on the phone. I get why they embodied, you know, a kind of IP
boogeyman
person, you know. Didn't quite catch on, although I think I say in the interview, and it's true, like, now's the time for a brain scan sequel, like, get Edward Furlong in there. But the technology hadn't changed that much. It was a pretty short. It's definitely changed a lot since, but I don't know. There were things I liked about the idea that, you know, video games hadn't advanced to the
right.
point where they are now. And so the closest thing, I think, to what BrainScan was trying to pretend to be would have been, at that time, like those weird kind of murder mystery clue games where you supposedly interact with. But Grand Theft Auto, like the Grand Theft Auto, I think, 3 was the one that, in my mind, revolutionized the experience of – I'm going to go play this game, or I'm going to just go smash windows and steal pizza from prostitutes, et cetera. But yes, whatever.
Well, it just embodied like all the things that as like a Fangoria reading kid. It was like video games and 1-900 numbers.
And being a peeping Tom.
And being a peeping Tom, exactly, exactly. I just never wanted Frank Langella to just show up at my front door. I mean, like, that's the good thing about Frank. Is he's just got this personality. He's just got so much power in his voice.
Right.
So I made my friend Charlie and Justin sit through BrainScan recently, and they were incredibly nice about it. The music is really great. I mean, I love that.
Oh, the music's
I love that
so
movie.
Good.
I mean, I can't again. I can't claim any sort of credit for what, you know, hit the screen as far as like, oh, look what they did. I mean, I thought they did a great job.
Yeah.
And I'll point out probably repeatedly here that at andrewkevinwalker.com, there's a bunch of scripts up there. And BrainScan is one of them. So you can go – there will be many things that I would say, hey, go read the script because I'm proud of how it made it to the screen as close to the script intended. Or in more cases, look what I intended and then look what happened.
I actually think that after I talked about BrainScan 3 months ago, two months ago, I think it was actually Craig who sent me the script.
Oh, that's right.
Because I remember talking about Demolition Man, and then all of a sudden I just got this script popped up in my inbox, and Craig's like, read this. And then I think BrainScan popped up. Yeah, he does that.
We probably should admit, but he does.
No, it's great.
BrainScan is there so that people can see. Yeah. Oh, he didn't create Trickster. Fuck him. And then weirdly, because we were talking, it's Magnolia is where all the Halloween stores are.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, Magnolia Boulevard.
And there's a white – I think it's literally called the White Elephant. I don't know if it's still there. But many, many, many years ago, I just happened to walk into what is essentially a kind of flea market or a kind of Goodwill, but it's not – people aren't donating stuff. I just was walking through one of the aisles. I saw some scripts, as you'll see at some of these places, like people have – put in scripts that – now you can hear my stomach rumbling. I didn't really eat much today. You know, there's scripts. There were some scripts, and I just grabbed one just completely out of the blue, and it was BrainScan.
No way.
Amazing.
It was so weird.
That's funny.
I think they were all BrainScan.
I remember in New York when I was going to film school, it was like you would walk down 23rd Street – and then there would be these guys that just lay blankets on the sidewalk selling scripts.
Yeah.
I had no qualms about stealing from those guys because I was like, you know what? You're stealing from the artist. I'm going to steal one. That's how I got John Carpenter's Vampires before it came out.
Wow.
And I was like, oh, look at that. I just like grabbed it and ran away.
I couldn't even pay the dollar that he was
not that guy. That guy's ripping off from everybody else. Fuck that. I was a starving artist. But I just remember when you were talking about the flea market. I was just like, I remember those guys selling
all up in along Broadway. There's books. There's guys with books. Yeah, scripts.
Scripts.
And then, of course, bootleg DVDs and stuff.
Yeah. Several iterations of Alien 3 I've bought scripts of.
Oh, Alien Resurrection.
Yeah, there's a million of them.
Yeah, that's how I read Joss Whedon's Resurrection script. Yeah.
Well, that was the thing. I mean, honestly, like there, when I was in school, my Penn State had, you know, they had a script for 2001: A Space Odyssey, and it was an amazing script. Yeah. It was one of those scripts that was like two lines of description, completely blank page, and then you turn the page. But that was almost it, and you couldn't get scripts. You could send off to New York or L.A., yeah. And I did. I sent for the script for Scarface, and it never arrived. They took my money order.
I think we could find it on the internet.
Well, that's right the thing. That's the beauty of it. Now you can self-educate.
Yeah.
I mean, is there still like kind of – I mean, going to film school, is there still kind of a rabid fan base of people who chase after – scripts? I mean, they don't do
smart and they want to learn about writing.
For sure, for sure. I'm just thinking about the fan base too that want to kind of dig in. I mean, like, they don't publish scripts as much. I don't see them at Barnes and Noble as much anymore.
Yeah, remember, like I bought, there's always like a little section, and it's you know, classics like Fargo,
right?
And
yeah,
certain
Shawshank
ones. But very often they're I warned you. My whole thing is always like, let's encourage the young writers of the world. Let's, you know, screenwriting should be an art, you know, even if it's just some art that's on your shelf and you'll never get a movie made. So be it. The scripts that are printed are usually, or often I should say, transcripts.
Right, right.
Whereas like there was a long time ago, a Faber and Faber 7-8 millimeter that even though they didn't really properly format it, it was word for word like the third draft of 7 and the very first draft of 8 millimeter. And that's why I throw these scripts up on my website, because I want people to see, like, here's what I tried to do with 8 millimeter. I've never seen the movie. I've heard about the movie enough to know it's not like this. Sleepy Hollow's on there, and you can see how it changed. Brain Scan. For whatever reason, the very first draft of 7 is there, and to see like, oh look, this idiot wrote like a 138 page script. You know, there's so many things to learn from the way people write versus what ends up on screen, and that's why those transcriptions are useless.
Yeah.
I often would ask, because you know, obviously we have a lot of friends even from before we were doing what we're doing now, but in the web world, anytime they'd finish a movie and it'd come out, I'd always ask them if they'd mind sending me their original script, because I kind of like to go back and see how it became what it became.
Right.
But I want to dive into 7, obviously, because it's an incredible piece of work, very dense, very angry, which I remember when I was at Tower Records, maybe. But there's an amazing story of how you got attention for it. How long did it take you to write? What was kind of going on in your life, and how did who was the first person to notice it?
I was writing it between after shifts at Tower Records, and so there's just a few hours each night, maybe, or whenever I would get around to it. And there was a big kind of period of research before. I'm a big proponent of research as far as, you know, even if you read this entire book for one piece of information, it was worth it. So how long? I mean, like nowadays it takes me 3 months. Once the research and the outlining is done, and I'm I do very detailed outlines. Mm-hmm. 3 months to write something. Usually, it can take a little longer, but it's almost like ends up being a month per act when I'm writing. Then I'm sure this was like over 6-7 months, not counting the research, because I was working a full time job. Which I think just goes to show again within the encouraging, you know, aspect of it, there are plenty of people out there who think about writing stuff and they're working and they just don't take that 1 hour or half hour. I mean, I know it seems useless to write a half a page when you're, you know, each day, but that will eventually add up. I knew that as I was writing 7, I knew that no one would look at it, you know, kind of just dropping across their transom like any of the companies. It was a time when you know, a lot of spec scripts were selling for like $1 million, which was a big deal. The Robin Hood script and Shane Black stuff, and I knew an agent wouldn't look at it without it being recommended. I had seen the movie Apartment Zero and the movie Bad Influence. Both had come out around that time. This would have been probably around 90-ish. Mm-hmm. 91 is probably when I left. Yeah. And Dave Koepp had been featured as a flavor of the month in Premiere Magazine. And Dave is one of the biggest screenwriters. And this was kind of early in his career. And both those movies he had written. And I really loved them. And I really liked Bad Influence. And I thought, So I called information from New York out to L.A., and Dave Koepp was just stupid enough to still be listed in the phone book. So I ended up speaking to his assistant at Universal because he had a deal at Universal. I just said, like, the agents won't look at stuff. Would he consider reading this script? Now, weirdly, I hadn't even finished writing it yet, which is so – I don't even understand what I was doing. But he said that he called back the same day, like, and said that he would read it, and then I quickly finished it. I mean, I remember when he called, I literally leapt for joy that he would read it. I finished it and then sent it to him, and I, you know, I signed a big release thing that essentially said that he could take it and I could – there would be no recourse. Mm. But I did that gladly to get someone to read it, and then he recommended it to his agent at the time, Gavin Pallone, who's been in my life and is a very close friend, and as is David. I mean, I just was lucky that this guy happened to be the nicest guy in the world, and he advanced it to people that could actually represent it. Mm-hmm. It didn't get optioned or anything right away. It didn't go out and make $1 million sale. It got optioned. It went out with a big round of people like producers, and then they all passed. And then it went out again, and they all passed, you know, producers or studios or whatever. And then it eventually got optioned by an Italian company, Pentamerica. Mm-hmm. And it was optioned for Jeremiah Chechik to direct, the guy who directed Christmas Vacation.
Wow. Wow. So how did Fincher step in? Because that would have been a different movie.
Well, the short kind of version of that is it was my first thing writing, obviously, I got a job writing, adapting a book called Lie to Me for Silver Pictures. That was my first job. And it wasn't a ton of money, but it was obviously more than Tower Records money. It was enough to move out to – I moved out from New York to Los Angeles with my friend, my buddy from college, John Silberg. When the time came to start meeting with Jeremiah Chechik, he had a bunch of notes that changed the script drastically. And I was like the – director is king, you know, like I did. I kind of dutifully did the best version I thought I could do of all these notes. But it's floating out there somewhere online. It did, I believe, there was no head in the box. Which, spoiler alert.
I was actually thinking that, and then you said it at the perfect time.
Well, it's just, I mean, look, I like to pretend that all the youngsters out there, it's just a matter of time before they all sit down and enjoy Seven, and going in clean and not really knowing it would be helpful, but whatever. I mean, everybody always talks about the thing. You know. So I did this big rewrite, and it ended in like, the ending was changed to like a church, a burnt out church that had a kind of tableau of seven deadly sins in the church. And it was really kind of a painful experience changing it so drastically. But here was the lesson that I learned, and I don't know what to take from it. If I hadn't suffered through and stuck around and been the one who bastardized the script and really I feel like made it, in my opinion, it just wasn't quite as good, then I wouldn't have been around after Jeremiah finally was off the movie and Pentamerica just kind of, because they had lost money on certain movies they were looking to partner, and then they ended up allowing Arnold Copelson to come in, and that's where Arnold kind of picked up the late, great Arnold Copelson,
yeah,
who just died yesterday, right, or the day before.
Yeah, this week.
So Copelson came in, and that's how I met Fincher. They brought in the director of Alien 3. Now, I don't stick around for stuff anymore. Like on 8mm, once Joel Schumacher started to make it into something that I wasn't happy with, end of the day, it's really hard to take something that you've written, especially a spec script that you did as an original, and hand back something you feel isn't getting better. So a lot of times I just say, look, no harm, no foul. You know, I handed you I'll steal one of Fincher's analogies. I handed you the blueprints for a house, and you want to make it into a yacht, go with God, make your yacht. But I'm, you know.
Yeah.
So anyway, the point is, I don't know what to tell people nowadays when they're rewriting their script for someone, because if I hadn't done those rewrites, then I wouldn't have been around when David Fincher came in and I dutifully had my little notebook on the table, like I do for some reason right now. And it was also a marble notebook. And he said, no, it's all right. Put the notebook away. Let's all just talk today. It was like a meeting with him and Copelson. I mean, I remember the moment I first laid eyes on David Fincher, and I only knew his work. I mean, I knew his music videos, and I knew, you know, but and I knew Alien 3, and I liked it. And I knew the struggle that he had gone through to make it what it was, and you knew if you read about it what it could have been. Mm. But I mean, I think very often recently how very, very different my life would be if I hadn't happened to cross paths with David Fincher. And I wouldn't have crossed paths with David Fincher because I wouldn't have been the current writer on Seven. They would have brought in whomever had done the last rewrite, or they would have, and then really quickly, because I'm going on too long, but they accidentally had sent – they sent Fincher by accident my first draft, which had
–
and he was talking to them and saying – he referenced something, probably the box, and they said, oh, wait, what? Oh, no, we sent you the wrong draft. And then they proceeded to send him the Jeremiah Chechik rewrite. And he said, oh, no, yeah, I wouldn't really want to do that, but this first draft, and that's how he saved it.
Wow.
And everyone along the line, like, who fought for that ending and for, you know, Brad and Morgan and Mike DeLuca and, you know, there's too many to name. They all deserve credit. But anyway, yes, I mean, Fincher, who – that then I did, you know, I rewrote on the game for him. I'm so very proud of everything I did with him, including the little bit that I did on Fight Club. I rewrote Girl Who Played with Fire for him. There's all this stuff that kind of is in my wake that'll never see the light of day, but that every experience of writing with him has been, besides the fact that, you know, I owe him Seven, and Seven is the one that they can never take away. I did a rewrite of 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea for Fincher. I did a Reincarnation in Peter Proud for Fincher. I mean, it's, you know, he and he's the greatest person. I mean, he's an incredibly great friend. I mean, he's – my life would be the tributaries of all my – he's the source of the Nile for all these really great friendships that I've had over the years, you know, more than 20 whatever years ago. Because of that day, I sat there and met David Fincher.
Wow. Did once the movie came out, how did that change your life? Because I don't remember if this was like a big hit right away or if it was something that kind of developed like this following over years. But was it your first big step into the business in terms of like
– the beauty of it was that even as it – the 5 years that it was around before it got made, which seemed like a long time, but it's not. I mean, I have scripts now that – are 15 years old, you know, however long, that we're still trying to kind of get stuff made, some of these things. But in the 5 years before it got made, even if people were reading and going, oh, good Lord, that's never going to get made. What dirty filth and how depressing. It was a great writing sample.
Right.
And so I got work. and or I got chances at jobs. And so but it, when it came out, it did well. I think it made like 14 million, and then the next week it made like 14 million. Like it was a weird thing that it didn't really drop. And it stuck around for 3 or 4 weeks that it was number one. It may have been just one of those word of mouth screens, you know. Well, it was just like – it just – so look, I mean that was again another thing where I would sometimes – and I still do have to stop myself and go, wait, this happened. It got made, but it also did well, and that was hugely important. So – and then someone reminded me recently, and I didn't quite realize that – was it 99 that 8mm came out, Sleepy Hollow came out, and I think Fight Club might have been the same year.
Yeah.
That's not even a career that I even recognize as like – I was like, what? Like I can't get – you know, it's very hard to get movies made, and I've had many, many, many years go by where I don't get movies made or, you know, a movie will get made like The Wolfman and I just never saw it because it wasn't the thing that I had done. So it changed my life in that I got – it changed my life. I mean because of the influence of Fincher just professionally and personally. But I was lucky enough that I was getting work from the script and it certainly helped for 8mm to sell as a spec, you know. You know, those were the days, I think, that I think – I don't – you know, I don't keep up on it as much as I should. But, I mean, specs still sell nowadays. But, I mean, that really was like, boom, $1 million spec this weekend. Boom. Every weekend there was some script that was selling for $1 million. I mean, I don't want to complain about nowadays. There's more movies being made now than ever. I do wish sometimes there was more middle budget stuff getting made nowadays. But – I loved a time when IP was the new stuff that was coming spec script-wise, you know, speculative scripts that were originals. And that still happens, but not quite in the same way. And like, you know, it is what it is. I mean, it doesn't mean that like – it's very hard, I think, for writers to write original scripts nowadays compared to other times. But I hope it doesn't –
Why is that? Why do you think that? Is it just because of the encouragement from the studios looking for?
No, I just think that specs don't sell like they used to.
Yeah.
I mean that I think that there's a certain amount of – no matter how small the following was – there was a time. I don't think it's the same. No matter how small the following was for a comic book – and I call them comic books.
Yeah.
They're not graphic novels. Just kidding. That they would rather have that IP than like an original or, you know, adapting a book, you know. So sometimes I think nowadays maybe it's better for people to try and write the prose and have the book be out there and then try and come back around to it. But, you know, there's no set formula and it doesn't mean specs don't still sell. It's just that there's – because IP is the word of the day even though it's not a word, it's what defines – like I think that you're – again, to be the screenwriter, zen kind of person who's hopefully a promoter of the art of writing in addition to the business of it, it's not good to listen to all the reasons why you shouldn't write something. You should be just going, I'm going to go write a movie that I want to see.
Yeah.
Because I've said many of these things time and time again. Writing Seven wasn't a canny business move where even at the time you would say, I'm going to write a movie with the most depressing ending I can think of. I just wrote the movie that I wanted to see and I thought, oh, this would be cool. And like it's – so listening to other people say, here's why you should write this, here's why you should write that, you know, there's – it's a bad habit. But I do think it would be hard for somebody to sit down now and say, I'm going to write a big movie, but it's a standalone. Hmm. And if you're writing it and it's not like the first of three or something, then it's hard to think like who's going to be interested. It's that kind of thing makes it a little more difficult, I think.
Do you think TV has anything to do with it either? I mean, it seems like everything.
Well, I think TV is where drama exists to a certain extent more than in features.
For sure, yeah.
If you don't mind, there's two particular horror-centric projects I wanted to ask you about, Sleepy Hollow being a big one, mm-hmm. Because obviously the story. But I've liked stuff that Tim Burton's done since, but I think that's like the last great Tim Burton movie for me because it was just kind of gory and over the top and crazy and stuff like that. But he wasn't originally linked to it when you first sold it. Is that true?
Well, the idea to do it was Kevin Yeager's idea. And Kevin is the guy who created and built literally the Crypt Keeper.
Yeah.
And Chucky and all – I mean Kevin's the greatest and
he's the greatest guy. Yeah, he's great.
And he – it was his idea to go adapt Sleepy Hollow. And there were many, many people after that, especially after the movie got made, who went, why didn't we go do Sleepy Hollow? Because it was public domain.
Yeah.
So I would go to Kevin's house like time and time again like to beat out the story with him. And so it was his idea and he was a huge part of developing the story. Mm-hmm. He was attached to direct it.
Oh, wow.
But it just kind of just never happened all the years we went around with it. It ended up with Scott Rudin and we just couldn't get it made. I don't even remember how it was that it got resurrected, but it got resurrected specifically because of Tim Burton. And ironically, or not, it's not the right word, but Kevin did effects on it, on the movie. That was one of the ones where kind of very close to it getting made, I didn't do some of the rewriting towards the end. So it changed a lot from the original script. But I think that movie's super cool. It's just there's some logic problems I have.
Mm-hmm. So that was that one of those cases where you kind of ducked out earlier rather than sticking around for the rewrites?
Well, I mean, it might be. Yeah, I mean, there were certain things I just felt like it was a really kind of close to production and there were big changes and I just stepped aside. It made more sense for someone else to try and do that.
Wow. And the other one, which I find surprising, you said you've never seen, but The Wolfman? Like, I kind of like the movie. But then I love The Wolfman, the original. Mm-hmm. Like, it's my favorite Universal monster.
Look, I mean, yeah, none of these – I mean, it is what it is when you're being asked to kind of make what you think – it could easily all be explained by me being a brat. You know, and being too stuck with the script being a certain way or whatever. Wolfman changed a lot.
But did you grow up with that character and have an affinity for him?
Like, yeah, I mean, I love all those Universal monster movies. The thing I think I wanted was I don't know how much I want to get too specific about it, but I wanted it to be really a dyed-in-the-wool kind of old school Universal horror movie. When Universal was talking about the Dark Universe, which came later, that's kind of what I pictured it would be, kind of like really grabbing a hold of the classic kind of feel in a way with both hands. So there was a certain point where a big pivotal scene was being taken out by the director at the time, and I just – because it was seen as kind of too much of a trope. And I was just saying, well, people with pitchforks and the torches is kind of like a good trope to have in a Universal monster movie. Yeah. And it was a scene that was like – it just happened to be – like I say, I don't want to complain about it. There was a fulcrum on which the entire story swung. And once you pulled that out – none of it made sense anymore, and I couldn't rebuild it. Hmm. So that, spoiler alert, this character who – there was a character who had to have good reason to go from doing a good thing by kind of shackling himself each full moon and protecting an entire town from his disease. He had to swing from that to going, fuck this, man. The shackles are off. And it wasn't like when you turn into a wolf man, you can go and say, I'm going to go get that guy. I mean, you go out and you could be killing women and children. So it needed a logical turn for why someone would turn against an entire town. So once this puzzle piece got pulled out, I couldn't figure it out. And so I've not seen it. I've heard about it. I'm really proud of that script, and it's out there so people could read it and compare it. I mean, it just is one of those things where, you know, the grist mill sometimes stuff changes, you know?
Yeah. No, it just feels, again, because I love that character so much, and so I was gonna like whatever Wolfman movie came out. But then, you know, something like Rick Baker finally getting the opportunity to do the stuff, and he wants to do this incredible transformation, and then the movie comes out and it's a CG transformation and it's kind of terrible. And then on the Blu-ray, you see Rick Baker's VHS tests of what he would have done for the transformation, and they're amazing.
And does it say why they didn't do it?
No, they're just like, no, they just opted to do
the I mean, the thing is, like, every one of these things, the stuff to me that's interesting is – and it's the point where I, and I think everyone, should decide, oh, here's where I want to try and have this job or not. And I understand I need a job, so give me a job. Now you pay me. Now I'll figure it out. For me, I'm too neurotic and lose too much sleep. So I never say, hey, let me work on Batman versus Superman. Oh, thanks. I have the job. You paid me. Now we'll figure it out. I have to figure it kind of to the nth degree and outline it. The cool problems to be solved with any werewolf thing are if someone turns into a werewolf and goes out and slaughters a bunch of people, when they wake up, they're either going to have to commit suicide or there's going to have to be a reason that they stick around or they're just evil.
Yeah.
So you see why, like in classics like American Werewolf in London, the transformation comes very late.
Yeah.
You know, with this one, it was if this happens that he inherits this family disease – in a way, and he goes out and kills. Instead of just going to jump off a cliff, he has got something he has to stick around to do. Mm-hmm. So for me with the Wolfman, when I decided, oh, I want to do this, was when I figured out a solid murder mystery that would be kind of great, almost kind of like – that's what took so long with Sleepy Hollow, figuring out the murder mystery.
Right.
And also going, oh, yeah, this is where – in the script, he gets inside this weird part of this. This is where we can have not just the classic Wolfman, but this middle part is the Werewolf of London. It includes him kind of climbing into a weird part of town that's kind of like a swamp, and you realize he's in the zoo and he fights an alligator. It included a part because of the period we had chosen where he briefly crossed paths with Jack the Ripper. And then in the third act, it had what I loved was werewolf on werewolf action. So it ticked all the boxes for me. It, you know, like I say, it could all be attributed that stuff got pulled out budgetarily, and I'm a brat and wouldn't change certain things. But I mean, I was very proud of that script because it delivered, like I said before, it was the movie I really wanted to see. It would have been so amazing, I hope. You know, Sleepy Hollow had a little bit of the final product that I think is amazing, but it doesn't quite deliver on a guy who has to choose between his head and his heart as much as I had hoped it would. But again, I'm a brat.
There's one. I had read somewhere that you had done a little bit of work on Event Horizon. Is that true?
I did. I went over to London for like a week, and I worked on it, but they didn't really end up using anything that I wrote. I think they talked – someone's talked about it somewhere.
Yeah.
I wrote a scene. I was proud of it. It was just a scene where they go on to the ship originally and we just wanted to kind of – they wanted to set a tone of like creepiness and stuff. And so I just had written a scene where they go in and it's, you know, a haunted house they're entering. And it was just that the only thing that they saw was weirdly out of place was floating in the weightlessness was a single tooth that had been pulled out by the root, like a bloodless tooth. Mm. So the things that I wrote then also had to do with the ending and trying to clarify the ending. But it was great to work with those people, but it was just, I think, them trying to deal with the ending and stuff, and they didn't use anything like that.
Yeah. You know, it's funny, talking to you, the 90s are shat on a lot in terms of the kind of genre. A lot of people, I remember growing up, and I remember my father kind of lamenting the demise of horror. Oh, well, it's not like the 80s or 70s or 60s and so on. But in this conversation, you're bringing up, and we're talking about so many titles that are so good.
Yeah.
Like Sleepy Hollow. I think Sleepy Hollow is fantastic, but even Event Horizon's very good, and Brain Scan is a lot of fun.
It was also pretend that Brain Scan was good.
It is good fun. Yeah, but that doesn't mean it's like. It's a lot of fun.
I love that people are even aware of it.
Yeah.
And one time someone came up to me and said, they knew, I don't know how they knew who I was, but because a friend of a friend or whatever. And then they were like, oh, I really love, and I expected them to say that they love Seven. And they said, I really love Brain Scan.
It must have been Josh Ethier or Joe Bigas.
It really made me happy because I realized – because whenever you're talking about – Seven's the one that I could mention to people and they go, oh, yeah, I saw that.
For sure.
Or they say, oh, I've heard of that. But it's funny to think about how my age aligns with some people now and how old they were when Seven was out, but especially how old they were when Brain Scan was out, when they were young enough to have that be one of their favorite movies, which is a big thing. Your youth is often so forgiving of plot. Contrivance or whatever, so that you're in love with these movies that people who were, just going, what are you talking about? That movie's garbage.
Well, listen, I talked about this. I've talked about the movie a few episodes back, and Rebecca called me out because she's like, you sound like an executive giving notes. And I was like, the mother and the, Eddie Furlong's leg thing, it doesn't really, I want it to pay off a little bit more and da da da. And she's like, you sound like an executive. I was like, yeah, but it's a genuine thing. I didn't think about it when I first saw it as a Fango reading kid. But now that I'm much older, I'm like a little bit more scrutinizing of it,
I definitely was trying to have Brain Scan have the underpinnings of a perverted little nerd who's a peeper being taught a lesson and then trying to get away with that ending so that it was like a total cop-out but still kind of worked, I don't know. So it was, again, in the script, probably you flash back to him on the freeway like 15 times. Right, it's so badly written, but the intention was that there be some subtext to it, that he be destroying all the things that he loves and getting rid of his friendships, and that it is me sitting years later in front of Grand Theft Auto knowing Liberty City better than I know my own neighborhood. It's all come to pass.
Yeah, keeps coming back to Brain Scan. I do want to mention Nerdland, which is your most recent thing, but before that, if you're okay with talking about it, because Ryan would find it interesting, is that you – at one point thought about or worked a little bit on an idea for Friday the 13th.
Well, I had talked to a director that they were talking to at the time about rebooting. It was forever ago.
Hmm.
I was saying to you when we chatted a little earlier that I would love to get my hands on – what I think is being done with Halloween is what is great. It should be done. I mean, I think that Friday the 13th, when it was being rebooted, that there was a potential to make the art version of that. I think that Texas Chainsaw Massacre is a piece of art, I think Dawn of the Dead is. There's certain ones that I think are elevating beyond just the gore fest. And I love the gore fest. But so, for Friday the 13th, I wanted to do like a weird kind of Jason road trip kind of, I had what I thought was a great pitch. Now, it was Some of it was informed by talking to the guys at Rockstar, speaking of Grand Theft Auto, Rockstar video games, about when they were trying to think about doing a Manhunt movie. And anybody who knows Manhunt, the video game, knows how hardcore that was and what that movie could be. And a lot of it was an obsession with that idea of point of view, which Siskel and Ebert, like many, many years ago, had the whole episode deriding the fact that you were being asked to see through the eyes of the killer, except for Halloween. They were okay with that. Yeah. But I ended up using a lot of the ideas from it from a spec script that I've written that we are still hoping to get made one day, which is called Psycho Killer. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of my tip of the hat to the hardcore, like, slasher genre, but with a really is a whole kind of structural thing that that's part of it that was the most interesting aspect of writing it.
Cool.
I'm all about this Manhunt talk. So how excited are you for – have you played Red Dead Redemption?
I played the first.
Are you excited about the second one?
The new one yet. Yeah. I mean the problem for me is I'm stuck now. I still just play Battlefield 4 with my brother. A lot of Minecraft and Battlefield 4. Yeah. So I'm behind.
Well, you're talking to the guy who just found out that Call of Duty Black Ops 4 is coming out. Yeah, I saw the billboard and I was like, oh, shit.
Yeah.
But Red Dead.
I can't keep up with some of those. I want to get back to playing like through. I want to play Quake again, when it first came out on. Well, I still have my 64, my Nintendo 64.
Nice.
Every once in a while, I drag it out and play Quake. That's probably my all-time favorite. And GoldenEye. But
yeah. GoldenEye is great.
It's great. Yeah, great. It changed that, and Grand Theft Auto 3 changed everything.
Yeah, yeah.
Mario 64. Mm. That world, creating worlds.
Yeah, yeah. Well, now everything is open world. I mean, like that. Rob, I got offline. We got to talk about the Spider-Man game.
Oh,
it's like Grand Theft Auto and Red Dead Redemption, where you can go off on little offshoots, but then you just swing around the city and do whatever you want.
Wow,
that's the whole.
It's insane. I mean, you can just climb up to the tallest peak and jump off and. No repercussions.
I would waste so much time if I invested in video games at this point. Yeah.
Well, that's the thing, because you can free roam, there's no time limit. You spend more time there than in the real world. It is dangerous.
I can't do that.
Would you direct?
I mean, by the time I get around to wanting to, the people will be saying, fuck you, you're not going to direct.
Yeah.
I get, like I said, I'm too neurotic about just writing. To spend, you know, all that energy and fear on 3 years or 4 years on a project, you know, in a way, if Seven hadn't happened and if I didn't have one or two that I'm so happy with and that I wouldn't change, you know, that I couldn't have ever hoped for it to be better, then maybe I'd be in a different headspace. But, you know, like I say, Seven's the one they can't take away. And luckily, they've never managed to quite do a sequel to it or a prequel other than a comic. And
there was a TV show that they were talking about at one time.
They talked about every possible thing, including there was a series of comic books about John Doe.
That's right.
Yeah. It just doesn't make sense to me to kind of color in the lines of a guy who's calling himself John Doe.
Yeah.
But anyway.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about Nerdland, which is one of the recent things you did, an animated thing with Paul Rudd, Patton Oswalt.
Well,
because I want people to know about this.
Well, Nerdland was a project I wrote a while ago that we made with the guys and ladies at Titmouse Inc., which are the animators who did Metalocalypse, which is one of my all-time favorites. And Super Jail, and they do Venture Brothers, et cetera. And they're amazing animators. And so we took a live action script. I went in to see Chris Panofsky and his wife Shannon, who created and run Titmouse, and somehow convinced them to go in on this with us. And they got an amazing cast, like you said, Paul Rudd and Patton Oswalt and Kate Micucci and Ricky Lindholm and Hannibal Buress. And it's just – I'm very proud of it. No one's seen it, which is why I made you mention it. No one's heard of it. It's there on Netflix. It trended maybe for a flicker. But, you know, it's like it's the guys in this room are the guys in that movie. And the people who are listening to this podcast are the people that movie's kind of about. It's kind of about screenwriting and acting kind of, it's about desperation that you feel when you first come to LA and you're trying to, you know, when everyone's moving into those weird apartments where you park, you tandem park underneath between the pillars, and you're living in Los Feliz and you're trying to break in. That's what Nerdland's all about.
That's awesome. I have to check that
out. I'm still kind of there with that parking spot. And
that's right. We all are.
all righty. Well, thank you so much for coming on, man, and chatting with us. I really appreciate
it. I wish I could have said something more intelligent and complained a little less. But
you were wonderful.
I'm just a jackass.
No, you're not. You're one of, as Ryan said, one of two screenwriters that he's always wanted to meet and have in. And obviously you have a website, andrewkevinwalker.com. You could find your scripts there, which
There's
is really
some
cool.
There, yes.
I'm going to dig back into the archives because I didn't know it was all there.
As I like to say, they're available for the price they're worth, free.
Well, thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks again.
Thanks, guys.
Yeah, we'll talk to you guys soon. See you next week.